Joe Palca, this is VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, December 8th, and you are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, back with you after a few days away. Coming up, the UK begins vaccinating its population against COVID-19.
A British grandmother has become the first person to receive Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine outside of clinical trials.
Also ahead, New Zealand releases the results of an inquiry into the Christchurch mosque massacre.
On behalf of the government, I apologize.
Plus, details on how Joe Biden will be inaugurated as U.S. president during the pandemic. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the UK. Britain began vaccinating its population today against COVID-19. It is the first Western nation to begin mass vaccinations and the first globally to roll out the shot made by pharmaceutical companies Pfizer and BioNTech. Margaret Keenan, a 90-year-old grandmother from Northern Ireland, was the first person in the world to receive the vaccine outside of clinical trials. Brian Wood of Reuters reports.
A British grandmother has become the first person to receive Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine outside of clinical trials. And with it, her home, the UK, is now the first country in the Western world to start mass vaccinations for the public. Margaret Keenan, a 90-year-old grandmother, received it early Tuesday morning at a hospital in central England, just a week before her 91st birthday. Known by her friends as Maggie, she's a retired jewelry shop assistant, a mother of two, and a grandmother of four. Britain has been the hardest hit by the pandemic in Europe, with over 61,000 dead, and its government is dubbing the vaccine rollout as V-Day. Priority is being given to people over 80, care home workers, and health workers. Although ultra-cold storage and logistics will limit this vaccine's mass use, Keenan's story may fuel hope in the fight against a pandemic that has crushed economies and killed more than 1.5 million people worldwide. She's told media, "I feel so privileged to be the first person vaccinated, and it's the best early birthday present I could wish for."
Thanks to Brian Wood of Reuters for that report. One of the world's largest COVID-19 outbreaks is in India. The country has reported over 9.7 million cases and over 140,000 deaths, according to the World Health Organization. But India's federal health secretary says the country could grant a license to some developers of COVID-19 vaccines in the next few weeks. Rajesh Bhushan says six vaccines, including AstraZeneca's COVID Shield and Bharat Biotech's Covaxin, are in trial stages. Bharat Biotech, Pfizer, and AstraZeneca have already applied for emergency use authorization in India. The preparations for vaccinations come nearly 1 year after COVID-19 first emerged in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters takes a look at what life is like now in the city made famous by the disease.
It's been almost a year since the first cases of COVID-19 were detected in central China, in the city of Wuhan, before there was an outbreak here and later the world's pandemic. China first alerted the World Health Organization to 27 cases of viral pneumonia in Wuhan on December the 31st. Since then, more than 67 million people have been infected with the virus, and some 1.54 million people have died. But aside from face masks, few hints remain of Wuhan's early role in the pandemic, even while many countries still struggle to contain the virus. In a wet market 15 minutes' drive from the epicenter of the Wuhan outbreak, shops hum with daily life. Sellers catch and gut fish, while visitors buy vegetables, live frogs and turtles. Vendor Ni Ginson shrugs off fear of the virus.
"I'm not afraid. What is there to be afraid of? The whole world is like this now."
Some say it didn't originate in Wuhan at all.
"It's definitely not China where the virus originated. You wouldn't find it in central China. It must have been brought over by someone else, don't you think?"
Wuhan was initially hard hit by the coronavirus, recording over 50,000 cases and nearly 4,000 deaths in the early months of 2020. Residents still remember the pressure of the 76-day lockdown they endured. When the city's empty streets were bisected by kilometres of thick yellow barricades that cut off businesses and kept people at home. But those memories are becoming more distant. As the city returns to a daily rhythm, Wuhan has not recorded a new locally transmitted case in several months, and China's relative success in controlling the virus has become a key talking point in Chinese state media. Local people like Hu Hang put it down to self-discipline and personal hygiene.
Everyone is quite strict with personal safety measures. People are always wearing masks when outside. I have been out of Wuhan and I realise that people from outside of Wuhan would never wear masks.
The city's recovery is in sharp contrast to other major economies heading into the holiday season. The United States recorded 15,000 deaths last week, the highest seven-day rate since April, while European countries have rolled out tight restrictions on gatherings ahead of Christmas.
That was Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. The world's largest COVID-19 outbreak remains in the United States, averaging over 201,000 new cases and over 2,200 deaths per day over the last week. The southeastern state of Florida has one of the largest outbreaks, averaging about 9,500 cases per day and almost 100 deaths a day over the past week. But on Monday, U.S. law enforcement agents in Florida raided the home of a top data scientist who helped build the state's online COVID dashboard. The scientist, Rebecca Jones, alleges she was fired from her government job because she refused to manipulate COVID-19 data. Jones, in a Twitter post, says her phone, quote, and all my hardware and tech, end quote, were confiscated in the raid. Jones posted home security camera footage of Monday's raid on her Twitter account, showing agents with weapons drawn yelling at unseen people on a second floor. The Florida Department of Law Enforcement says the agents were executing a search warrant on suspicion that Jones hacked into a state's Department of Health communications system. Jones told USA Today that she did not hack into any government system. She has said she was dismissed because she would not manipulate data to support the state's reopening of the economy. The office of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis in May defended Jones' firing, telling the Miami Herald she had been insubordinate and unilaterally changed the state's COVID dashboard. It's been nearly 21 months since a white supremacist gunman killed 51 people in a mosque in Christchurch, New Zealand. Today, a Royal Commission of Inquiry into the incident released a report about the attack. The report found that New Zealand security agencies had been, quote, almost exclusively, end quote, focused on the threats from Islamist terrorism rather than white supremacists, and that police failed to enforce proper checks on firearm licenses. Libby Hogan of Reuters reports.
A review of last year's mosque massacre in New Zealand found the country's security agencies were, quote, almost exclusively focused on the threat from Islamist terrorism rather than other threats, including white supremacists. Brenton Tarrant, the man who killed 51 Muslim worshippers in Christchurch last year, is a white supremacist. On Tuesday, New Zealand's Royal Commission of Inquiry gave the results of its investigation into what was the country's worst ever killings. They criticised authorities for ignoring repeated warnings from the Muslim community that hate crimes against them were escalating. And they also found that police failed to enforce proper checks on firearm licences. But despite those faults, the commission said there were no failings within government agencies that would have alerted them to the imminent massacre. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who received global praise for her compassionate response to the attacks, apologised on Tuesday after the report was released.
While the Commission made no findings that these issues would have stopped the attack, these were failings nonetheless. And for that, on behalf of the government, I apologise.
Ardern reacted to the attacks by swiftly banning the sale of the high-capacity semi-automatic weapons used in the attack. She also launched a global movement against online extremism. The report recommended a new National Intelligence and Security Agency, as well as a new minister to carry out the 44 recommendations. The government said it would also create a ministry and graduate program for ethnic communities to support New Zealand's diverse population. Hours later, Abdighani Ali, speaking for the group that manages one of the targeted mosques, said the report did not go far enough.
We've known for a long time that the Muslim community has been unfairly targeted with hate speech and hate crimes. This report shows that we were right. The report shows that institutional prejudice and unconscious bias exists in the government agencies and that needs to change.
Another proposal includes mandatory reporting of firearm injuries to police by health professionals. Tarrant himself was treated by doctors in the months leading up to the attacks after accidentally shooting himself. Staff never alerted police to his injuries. Tarrant was sentenced to life in prison without parole in August for the attack, the first time New Zealand has ever handed down such a sentence.
Thanks to Libby Hogan of Reuters for that report. This is VOA. China today summons the acting top U.S. diplomat in Beijing to protest about U.S. sanctions on 14 Chinese officials over Hong Kong and vowed to take, quote, reciprocal, end quote, countermeasures. The United States on Monday imposed financial sanctions and a travel ban on all 14 vice chairpersons of China's National People's Congress over their role in adopting a national security law for Hong Kong and for Beijing's disqualification last month of elected opposition legislators in Hong Kong. China also criticized the U.S. Tuesday over the sale of more military equipment to Taiwan. Opposition demonstrators blocked streets in Armenia's capital today to start a protest campaign after the Prime Minister, Nikol Pashinyan, ignored their call to step down. Protesters want Pashinyan to resign because he signed a ceasefire agreement that ended a bloody six-week conflict with neighboring Azerbaijan over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. The agreement stipulates that Armenia surrender territory to Azerbaijan. Pashinyan has accepted responsibility for the conflict's outcome, but said he is now responsible for ensuring national security and stabilizing the ex-Soviet republic of around 3 million people. Australia finalized plans today to make Facebook and Google pay media outlets for news content, a world-first move aimed at protecting independent journalism that has been strongly opposed by the internet giants. The law amounts to the strongest check on the tech giant's market power globally. Facebook's Australia managing director says the company will review the legislation and work with Australia's parliament. A representative for Google declined to comment. Until recently, most countries have stood by as advertisers redirect spending to Facebook and Google, starving newsrooms of their main revenue source and bringing widespread shutdowns and job losses. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The United Nations is renewing its appeal for humanitarian access to civilians in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. Hundreds of thousands are believed to be in dire need of assistance after more than a month of fighting in the area. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
It has been nearly 1 week since the Ethiopian government agreed to allow unimpeded, sustained, and secure access for humanitarian supplies to reach those in need in Tigray. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has repeatedly appealed to Ethiopian authorities, including Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, to live up to their agreement, but to no avail. The UN Refugee Agency reports the humanitarian situation is becoming increasingly critical the longer fighting goes on. Those most at risk, it says, are internally displaced civilians and some 96,000 Eritrean refugees in camps close to the combat zone. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says his agency has received worrying information that many of the Eritreans may have fled their camps and may be widely dispersed in the region and beyond.
We have reports of refugees looking for food and safety in Mekele and other areas inside Tigray. We also have reports of Eritrean refugees reaching a location called Gondar in Amhara region. And we are also assisting some of those who have reached Addis Ababa.
Many of the Eritreans fled to Ethiopia a decade ago, seeking refuge from persecution and forcible conscription in the Eritrean military. The UN estimates 2 million people in and around Tigray need humanitarian assistance, and some 1 million people have been displaced by the fighting. The UNHCR reports nearly 50,000 refugees have fled to eastern Sudan since Ethiopian troops began their assault on Tigray November 4th. Baluch says the number of refugees arriving in Sudan recently has gone down to an average of 400 to 600 every day, down from a high of thousands per day a week ago.
There are concerns about refugees who want to leave and flee and seek safety in Sudan and may have been prevented. Refugees who are arriving are reporting increasing number of checkpoints, very hard for them to reach, but they're still making it to Sudan.
Baluch notes the Ethiopian government's telecommunications blackout since fighting began in Tigray continues, making it very hard to know what is happening there. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has tapped retired U.S. Army General Lloyd Austin as his defense secretary, sources say. If confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Austin will become the first black person to hold the post. For more, I reached out to VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in Washington. Carla, thank you for joining us. How are you today?
Good. How are you, Jason?
I'm doing very well. First of all, Carla, can you explain a bit about retired General Austin's background and experience?
Well, retired General Lloyd Austin has been known as a soldier's soldier. He has risen, he rose very highly in the ranks at the Pentagon. He was the head of U.S. Central Command. When I started at the Pentagon back in 2014, he was there from 2013 to 2016 when he retired. And that's important to note because if he is the pick that is announced, as we expect and as we have heard from sources, then he will need a congressional waiver in order to be the Secretary of Defense, because in the United States, you have to be, if you're a military officer, you have to be out of active duty military for at least 7 years. And he's only been out for, you know, just shy of 5 years. So he will have to do that. This is not something that is completely uncommon. It happened just recently under President Donald Trump. He selected retired General Jim Mattis, and he had to have a waiver because he had not been out the full 7 years. And then before George Marshall, decades ago, was also selected and also had to go through that waiver process. So it can be done, but there may be some pushback from Congress, congressional members who really want to stress that separation between civilian leadership and military leadership.
And of course, if he's confirmed, he will be the first black Secretary of Defense. How significant is that for the U.S. military?
Absolutely. That would be very significant. He was the first African-American to lead U.S. Central Command, which oversees operations in the Middle East. So the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, that was what he was covering. And he was the first leader, the first African-American leader there already. So this would be a huge deal for the Pentagon. He was really pushed for by the Congressional Black Caucus. In fact, a lot of people have said that they had a hand in his selection over the other frontrunner candidate, Michelle Flournoy. Michelle Flournoy is a former senior Pentagon official. She was under the Obama administration. She served as the Undersecretary of Defense there, and she would have been the first female Secretary of Defense. But there was that pushback from people on two fronts. A lot of the progressives were concerned that she was a little too hawkish for the Biden administration because she had helped build up these policies that had increased the number of troops in Afghanistan, for example. And then also the Congressional Black Caucus really felt that it was time for an African-American. Either one would have made history, which was pretty incredible. And then the third person on the short list, so to speak, was Jay Johnson, who was the Homeland Security Secretary under President Obama and who would have also been the first African-American to be selected.
And as you said, he's a soldier's soldier, so he's definitely not an outsider. But what does he bring to the U.S. military or to U.S. defense policy? Is he someone who might be shaking things up, or is he likely to bring a similar approach as previous secretaries?
Actually, his willingness to be a soldier's soldier may be one of the reasons that he won over above Jay Johnson or Michelle Flournoy. Sources have said that Michelle Flournoy, she will push her ideas. Jay Johnson will push her ideas. And it may be that because Austin will not push as hard as the other two. And clearly, as an experienced general, he is going to push his ideas. He's been advising presidents for years, advising defense secretaries. But that might have been to his advantage that he might not be quite as forceful as the other two choices. We will wait and see how that plays out if he is selected and if he is confirmed.
So it sounds like even though he comes from a unique background for this position and he's been pushed by some lawmakers because of that background, his approach to the job might be a bit more traditional.
Right. And he does know the fights that the United States is currently in. He knows very intricately the situation in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq, the situation in Syria. The concern is, as we have seen for the past few years, the United States is trying to pivot to a potential conflict with a great power such as China or Russia. This is where he is not quite as versed because he was the head of U.S. Central Command. So as Michael O'Hanlon told me from the Brookings Institute, he will have to kind of study up on this to be ready to handle the great power competition expectations that he will have if he takes the reins at the Pentagon.
That's VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot, Jason. Appreciate it.
Plans are underway for the inauguration of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the United States. VOA's Steve Reddish looks at the pandemic's impact on the planning.
Construction of a platform on the Capitol steps and a reviewing stand in front of the White House are the familiar clues that America's quadrennial winter festival, a presidential inauguration, is just around the corner.
Thank you, Mr. President-elect. A lot of people are wondering what your inauguration is going to look like, considering...
So am I.
All smiles aside, Biden is not alone in wondering how the coronavirus pandemic will affect the festivities attached to his swearing-in. Laura Brown is the director of the George Washington University Graduate School of Political Management. She says most Americans who watch the inauguration on television will notice the difference once the cameras cut away to the audience.
I think what you are more likely to see are sort of spaced out chairs, perhaps with actual tickets to access the space, and a way in which to make sure that people are safe even though they are out of doors. I imagine, too, that masks will be mandatory.
The United States Constitution mandates what is said when taking the oath of office and when it takes place. Biden admits the usual ruffles and flourishes will be missing from his inauguration.
My guess is there probably will not be a gigantic inaugural parade on down Pennsylvania Avenue. But my guess is you'll see a lot of virtual activity in states all across America, engaging even more people than before.
Laura Brown says crowd size will not be an issue at Biden's inauguration.
We are not going to see the president and the first lady dancing at each one of the major states' balls. We are not going to see, you know, huge numbers of Americans packed on the street waving the parade forward. This is going to be a time of seriousness, substance, austerity, and purpose.
President Donald Trump has yet to concede the election and is reportedly considering holding a competing event to kick off his 2024 presidential campaign. Biden said his inauguration team is being more imaginative because of COVID-19.
First and foremost, and my objective is to keep America safe, but still allow people to celebrate and see one another celebrating.
Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
That was VOA's Steve Reddish, and that's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and today's editor, Keith Wallace. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.